driving, and when you're going from point A to B, I need you to stay safe, please, so always remember this beat.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Mel.
And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
KPFT is supported in part by Face to Face Enrichment Center, a 501c3 nonprofit organization devoted to uplifting youth, young adults, and families by providing educational experiences, outreach, and mentorship. The center's annual youth recognition banquet, A Night with the Stars, will be held on March 21st at 7 p.m. at the Humble Civic Center. Doors open at 6:30 and the program begins at 7. For more information, facetofacecenter.org.
KPFT Houston, People of Earth is next.
Crying looking for you. I'm crying looking for you.
This is KPFT Community Radio, 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 FM in Huntsville. Thank you for being with us tonight for People of Earth, Indigenous radio that advocates for Indigenous peoples, communities, self-determination in honor of those who have gone before and the resilience of the Indigenous that is today very much alive.
About the wars, and to be honest, I can't take it anymore. I hear you every day, the awful words you say, but hate can't be the face of the American dream. I've been thinking about my life. How one day I want to be a mother and a wife. I've been scared of that thought too. In a world of struggle, what are we gonna do? I hear you every day saying it's gonna be okay, but hate can't be the face of the American dream.
To believe the
that change is a choice, and it can start with me. And change is a choice, and it can start with me. And change is a choice, and it can start with me.
Rhea Zaragoza, this can't be the American dream. The American dream. And now this from Climate Radio Theater here on People of Earth.
Welcome to Climate Change Theater Action. Each year, 50 playwrights contribute short plays about climate change, which are performed around the world. The following plays were recorded in Arcata, California. The first, Blood on the Leaves, was written by Madeline Syatt, a member of the Mohegan Tribe and executive director of the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program. It's based on the traditional story of the hunter and the bear, passed down by Gladys Tantaquidgeon. Syatt lives in Connecticut, where warmer temperatures and stress from drought are taking the red out of fall leaves. As the play begins, two old friends step outdoors on a fall evening.
The stars. We need to check the stars. It's too cloudy. Can you see? What are they doing? Who? The hunter and the bear? Can you see them?
Why? My show's about to come on. It's cold. What are we doing out here?
It's very important. We need to figure out what they are doing.
It's too dark. They're just stars. Why does it matter?
Just stars? Those lights matter more than you can possibly imagine.
You're acting crazy.
When was the last time you saw blood on the leaves?
Okay, now I know you're crazy. I'm going back inside.
What color is this leaf?
Brown.
Exactly. Something is very, very, very wrong.
Oh, my God. You New Englanders and your leaves. You are so weird. I'm going back inside.
It's not about the leaf. It is bigger than the leaf. Look at the leaf and look at the stars and tell me what you see.
I don't see anything. Actually, I do see something. I see a crazy person running around talking about blood on leaves.
I'm not crazy. I'm upset. We need to find the hunter. He's stopped doing what he is supposed to do.
Right. I have just followed a psychopath outside. It is now confirmed.
Many things have happened since the beginning of time. To maintain balance in the world. A long, long time ago, the hunter and the bear were friends, great friends. The Great Spirit told the hunter he had to kill the bear.
What? I thought you said they were friends.
They are. That's the point. He didn't want to do it. He never wants to do it. But he has to do it. For the leaves. Every year at the end of summer, the hunter will not want to kill the bear, but he must do it. The bear will not want to die, but die he must. It's their duty to the earth. When the hunter kills the bear's blood and fat drips down onto the leaves as he roasts the meat. And the dripping fat and blood is what causes the leaves to change colors. Ooh, not helping.
Okay, but the leaves aren't changing color. They're just brown. So why are we crazy chasing the sky?
People forget why they have to do things. The leaves don't change color for us. We have to make sacrifices for them.
And this is a big deal? Why?
Our entire world operates this way. He is supposed to be our reminder that we must sacrifice for each other. And every time this is forgotten, we take one step closer to...
You're paranoid.
You are holding a brown leaf in autumn.
Maybe it's a good thing. Maybe the bear will get to stay alive. Go, bear, go.
And who dies instead? There are sacrifices we must make for the world to go on as it should. What would you do if you were the hunter?
Go inside and watch my show. Maybe make some popcorn. Order a pizza.
Why did I even ask? New England, people come for the foliage. They admire it. Judge whether it was as good as the year before. But most people don't know where it came from. They don't know the stories that come from the ground we stand on, the sky above us. Those stories remind us that balance is required, and without it, everything stops working.
So, let's say this year, the hunter doesn't want to kill the bear, and he drops down to the world and gets a television and a microwave.
And the hunter buys a suit and builds a skyscraper, and the leaves, they stop turning.
I'm tired of this. I've got to go inside. I want to watch my show.
You don't care?
Just a leap. It's just a story. I'm sure the constellation will show back up later when it's less cloudy. Let it go.
Please come back. We need you to light the way.
Sonny Drake is a Canadian playwright who writes climate comedy. His play, Absolutely Nothing of Any Meaning, begins with a couple in their cluttered living room, in the dark, in floodwater up to their knees.
Are you finished yet?
I'll read it out.
Maybe we should get sandbags and buckets first.
Our entire house is now one giant bucket.
Hurry up and read it then.
Dear, you're so impatient.
I think we're kind of in a hurry here.
Fine. Blah, blah, blah. Here we go. And so our usually very comfortable living room has now become a disaster zone. Do you want to just read it yourself?
Keep going.
This catastrophic mess is from your total mismanagement and insatiable greed.
Good, good.
To be more specific about the calamity we are enduring, the description is completely wrong. Fully folded out, it is 42 inches wide. In what world is this full size? You sent us a twin-size sofa bed, Amazon. And it should be illegal to call this salmon-colored. It is closer to a Tuscan red. It smells like a wet dog and is held together by staples and a prayer. Like, literally, the packaging is excessive and environmentally unfriendly. If we could give this a negative star rating, we would. Do not buy this couch.
So, should we talk about it?
I already pressed submit. People deserve to know.
I meant about the flood.
Oh, that.
Okay, let's not discuss it then.
We always discuss everything.
We never discuss anything of actual importance.
True.
Are your feet soaking wet?
I told you, my knees are wet. So what does that say about my feet?
I wasn't sure if you might have stood on something. Maybe on the couch.
As if anyone could stand on that couch without falling and breaking
their neck. I told you we should have bought a futon.
Are you gloating at a time like this?
That thud sound, could that be a person floating in?
I don't think so.
Could you turn the light on?
I can't reach.
The switch is right next to you.
But if I try and fail, then that could be emotionally devastating.
But it's right next to you.
Yeah, but it might not work.
Well, that would be good to know so we can buy another switch.
We won't ever buy anything from you again, Amazon.
Ever. What was that?
Nothing.
Was that you ordering something?
Amazon sent a sale on a flashlight.
But we have the light switch.
It was a really good sale.
What's the delivery time?
Knowing Amazon, it'll probably take a whole day.
Can you just turn the light on while we're waiting?
Can you turn the light on?
I don't have time to turn the light on.
What the hell are you doing?
Absolutely nothing of any meaning.
That is surprisingly time-consuming.
Are you sure you can't just reach over and switch the switch?
Fine.
Wait.
What?
Well, I was just thinking...
What?
Do we really want to see?
We've tried that before.
We try it multiple times a day.
It's really overwhelming.
The light goes on.
There it all is.
It feels impossible to fix it all.
And then we feel totally helpless.
And so the light goes off.
And then on.
And then off. That lit things up for a microsecond.
Yeah.
You know what I think is a bummer?
What?
The speed of light is this cosmic speed limit that just sets the tone for everything. It's such a downer.
Now is not the time for one of your philosophical meltdowns.
Ugh.
What happened?
I hate the part where your butt gets wet. Probably why I never learned to swim.
Would you prefer if it was slower or faster?
I'd prefer to not have a flood gushing through our home at all.
I meant the speed of light. Not that it matters since we won't switch it on.
We switch it on multiple times a day. We just discuss that.
We discuss complete lies all the time.
Good point.
There's just no point switching it on when all you can see is Tuscan red. You should be ashamed, Amazon.
Really, there's nothing wrong with the dark.
The dark is very important. Introspection, intuition.
Figuring out what really matters.
But do we?
What?
Introspect.
We don't have time to just stand around and introspect.
I'm not exactly standing.
Why are you not standing? The water must be filthy.
What defines standing in water versus swimming versus drowning?
Look who's getting philosophical now.
What's the meaning of life?
Who am I?
So then, who are you?
Well, I don't know.
Okay, who do you want to be?
I want to be someone who switches on the light. Like a person who faces it all, and then does something about it.
Hang on, Is this a metaphor a bit problematic for blind people? Equating a lack of seeing with ignorance?
Good point.
We should be inclusive.
Definitely.
Let's keep the light off.
For equality.
Yes.
Good. Although I don't know if that's what blind people are asking for.
The thudding sound again.
I think it really is a person.
Probably.
Hello? Do you need help?
You're most likely dead.
I'm going to turn on the light.
Wait. That'll be the flashlight delivery.
Hurry up so we can find them.
Oh my god, Amazon, you sent a flashlight without any batteries?
Seriously?
What the hell?
Disgraceful.
And the packaging.
It could fit a dead body.
0-star rating.
We will never buy anything from you again, Amazon. Did we order batteries?
Just did.
So who do you want to be?
What?
Before, when I said I wanted to be someone who...
I wish you were taller than me.
Why?
It's up to my armpits, which means it must be nearly... Let's turn the light on. Really this time.
Hello, from your friends at the corporations. Criminals have been apprehended for the spreading of fake news about the existence of light switches. There is no such thing as light switch. We are all already living in the light.
Could that be true?
Do not be drawn into this light switch hoax, as it may destroy the economy, resulting in catastrophic loss of jobs.
I'm switching it on.
Wait! I don't want to lose my job.
You're about to lose your life.
Those attempting to find this light switch will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
I'm turning it on.
But we might go to jail.
Or we may just kill you.
Oh.
So laze lavishly in your luxurious indoor lake. Salmon swishing swiftly by as the sea breeze strokes your brow. Gaze out at the Tuscan red sunset. This is your time. Finally, relax.
That does sound kind of nice. Ah, the light! My eyes!
Oh my god, I'm onto something. You're nearly...
Turn it back off!
No!
Turn it off! Give me back my Tuscan red sunset!
Help!
My sunset!
Help!
Our final play, The Project Hope, is by another Canadian, Catherine Banks. It opens in a laboratory which is dark, except for the light emanating from a row of glowing glass jars.
It's over. This Hope project of yours has failed. I've closed it down. The lights have been...
Yes. Turned off weeks ago.
Look, you told us people would leave Dirt Renewed.
They are renewed.
But renewed to action?
Energy has been created. Look, the power's been turned off for weeks, yet these jars grow with light.
Doctor, these are simple tricks that a child could do with a toy chemistry set.
You didn't want to shut the project down, did you?
Who wants to feel completely without hope? But there's been no action, so...
What if you're the fulcrum? You are the thing that will play the essential role in the Hope Project and the world. Would you participate?
Ridiculous. Me? No one person is the solution to the changes coming. Already here.
Do you know there are stumps of trees felled 500 years ago that live on yet under the earth, nurtured by the trees around them? Think of it. Whole networks of trees gathering light from the surface, moving the nutrients down to their own roots, but then pumping sugar to the roots of those stumps unable to gather their own nourishment. And for what end? Will the stumps push out a branch with leaves ever again? What is it that compels the surrounding trees to continue to support the lives of something that, to you and me, is dead? Some level, the nourishing trees must believe that one day the stumps will revive and thrive.
I fought for this project and you talk of dead stumps? Unbelievable.
No, not dead. Living still. Aren't you curious about the memories in these here jars?
Memories?
Memory as kinetic energy.
Does that even make scientific sense?
Memories transferred into energy. Let's say that. I can't tell you how it happens. I only know that it has, over and over again. Sit down and I'll show you. Here, hold this empty jar in your right hand. Now, tell me your first memory of the natural world.
When I finish, it is understood the project is over?
You'll get to decide. I'll give you that.
I was 4 years old.
Present tense, please. It helps.
I am behind the house by myself. My mother watches from the window. It's hot, really hot, and there are flying grasshoppers in the long grass all around me. Are there flying grasshoppers any longer?
I see them in your memory.
I catch one. I can't believe it, but I do. I cut my hands together. I feel his straw legs moving around in my palms. I peek in at his eyes. Ugh, those eyes. He spreads out his wings and it scares me a little and I drop him. My palm has a little brown spot. Molasses. That's what we say. He's left his molasses behind. I don't understand. There was nothing in the jar and now it's glowing.
It glows with your purest wonder of the natural world. This light in a jar, it's my memory. The first time I know that I know the name of the bird fishing at the river's edge. Kingfisher. And I'm 6.
What good are memories, however magical?
If you're asking what the outcome will be, I don't know. I only know we're forgetting the beauty of the world. We see the present as everything on the brink. We see the future destroyed by drought or floods or fire. And yet, if we tell the purest beauty of the world experienced by our child selves, there is created, I believe, a nourishing energy for the planet. This energy is my kingfisher. This is your flying grasshopper. Can we hope that the Earth will be sustained by this energy for as long as it takes until the moment of the planet's renewal arrives?
The energy of...
wonder. You are the fulcrum. I am the fulcrum. Out there, their memories are the essential elements to keep the world alive. You can close down the project, or we can go out into the world and ask everyone over and over again, what is your first memory of the natural world? Until we've created enough energy, like those nourishing trees, to care for, to sustain and renew the world, we can hold enough memory for the world to retrace its own blueprint. Is wonder energy? Is hope action? You decide.
Every performance in this global festival ends with an action that the audience can take. One of the simplest and most powerful actions you can take is to start a conversation with someone you know. According to surveys by the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, while a majority of Americans are worried about climate change and wish for government action, many feel that they are alone in their concern. And 2/3 of Americans rarely or never discuss global warming with friends and family. Breaking that silence is the first step. Talking about one of these plays and your reaction is an easy way to start.
That was from Climate Radio Theater. This is People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. I'd like to say at this time that People of Earth will be moving to Tuesday nights from 7 to 8, starting after next week. Please hang in there with us here at People of Earth. Please tune in on Tuesday night, same time, 7 o'clock. And now, this next piece is has a very good information about Houston. And this comes from Mothering Earth, and it is about our town here. So it's some really good information. So again, this is KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org, 89.5 in Galveston, 99.1 in Huntsville, and KPFT Houston. So let's go now to this Mothering Earth piece. And I'm Jacqueline Batiste.
Welcome to Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. I'm Salwa Khan. This truly gigantic industrial complex, operated by multinational corporations, pollutes the air, water, and soil with toxins that result in numerous health impacts, such as cancers, respiratory and cardiovascular diseases, and more. An activist group called Fenceline Watch has made it their mission to advocate for the people who live next to these plants. I spoke with Yvette Arellano, founder and director, and Shiv Srivastava, policy director of Fenceline Watch. I asked Yvette to explain their purpose.
Our mission is to stop toxic multi-generational harm on our Fenceline communities. We are a community-based environmental justice group on the east end of Houston, home of the largest petrochemical complex in the nation, second largest in the world. And we have three main pillars of work: petrochemicals, chemical disaster, and protecting the democratic process.
I'm curious about the name Fenceline Watch. How did you come up with that?
Communities in the Gulf Coast, for the most part, lack zoning. And that means you can put a fossil fuel project, whether it's a refinery or a petrochemical facility, a pipeline, or a storage tank, right next to a school, a home, a elementary school or kindergarten, a center, hospitals. And so there is no buffer zone between these dangerous fossil fuel infrastructure projects and communities. So communities right next to these fossil fuel projects are part of the fence line, and they're considered fence line communities. Here at Fenceline Watch, we keep an eye on the fossil fuel infrastructure projects that are dangerous to our public health, whether that's keeping community abreast of permitting projects or exposing and bringing to light the toxic harm that communities then have to take on the burden of. So we're here watching the fence line, and that's how Fenceline Watch came about for me.
Tell me about the neighborhood in which you're located and where you do your work.
I'll give one neighborhood, Manchester and Magnolia, where over 90% Latino. We have a massive Spanish-speaking population. There's a bilingual school in our community that's over 64% English language learning. So folks are learning English for the first time. And it's a low-income community throughout the East End and for the majority of the Houston Ship Channel. So there's a lack of resources for healthcare, education, and job opportunities. Our communities are present pretty much adjacent to historically Black communities. That means we struggle not only with status, but also fears of family separation, language barriers, and petrochemical exposure. So that's what our communities look like. They look like predominantly migrant communities, whether we're speaking Spanish or Vietnamese, and we're buttressed up against these really dangerous fossil fuel infrastructure projects.
How many industrial plants are located in that neighborhood, and what are they producing?
The Houston Ship Channel area spans about 52 miles. The first 16 miles are what we really keep abreast of. And that encompasses over 600 petrochemical facilities and their subsidiaries. That's not only the projects themselves, but these massive tank yards. So massive tanks that hold petrochemical products. And And I would say the fumes and off-gassing that comes along with it. So that's the piece about chemical disaster that Fence Line Watch also does. With so many chemical facilities, we're bound to have a flaring. That means at the top of these massive towering stacks, you can have these fireballs pretty much light. And they're supposed to be a safety system. But in reality, it's an everyday or a nightly burden. These odors come from these facilities and leach inside of homes. And places like where we work also, we have window AC units. And so that exposure is that much more intense. It can happen at all hours of the night, including when we're sleeping or walking around in a park or going to a softball game or a soccer game. So there is really no division that would keep us safe from exposure.
Do the people who live in the neighborhood work at these industrial plants?
There's this misconception that a plant or a factory is going to operate in a small town that has, let's say, a meat packing plant. For the most part, these facilities contract workers from outside of the state to come and work at facilities. So they lack benefits and union representation and a lot of protections. Folks within our communities have your standard, 9-to-5 jobs, sometimes 2 at a time, working at grocery stores and within, other opportunities, but very rarely inside of facilities.
And what are the environmental issues faced by the residents there?
This is everything from having trouble breathing at night because there are releases of emissions from the petrochemical facilities. And these are oxygen-displacing chemicals. And so you're waking up gasping for oxygen or having a hard time breathing. In our communities, you can wake up to trembling from a facility, whether it's expanding or it's operating, or it's having some kind of construction on the site. When there's a chemical disaster, there are explosions, massive amounts of heat that are radiating from the fires themselves, and then an immense odor of chemicals that gives you nausea or headaches, vomiting, and in worst case scenario, shelter in places where you're forced to stay inside of your home, close all windows and doors, and cover them with tarp and duct tape. And then you're uncertain how long this is going to last. So it could be anywhere from a matter of hours to days, which we've experienced. And so that also includes cutting off of streets. So the streets will shut down and there's no way for you to evacuate from the neighborhoods that are being directly impacted. That means grocery stores, schools, and the place where you might work would be shut down for an undisclosed amount of time. So your access to food and water and medication starts putting you in other hazardous conditions.
Let's get you in on the conversation, Shiv. How often are there leaks of dangerous gases or fires at these plants? And when that happens, are residents given any type of warning?
The Houston Ship Channel, it's home to over 600 chemical facilities. It's the largest petrochemical complex in the nation. It's the second largest in the world. So dangerous leaks, gases, and fires and explosions are unfortunately extremely common. Whether it's something like the flaring that Yvette was describing earlier at a facility that happens daily, or the odors of noxious gases that, kind of just sit and hang over our communities along the ship channel, it's quite common. Larger chemical disasters, unfortunately, are rather common too. So that's a massive explosion or a massive fire at a plant that go beyond even flaring and fumes. You have to cover your windows with plastic and switch off your air conditioner and stay in your home until you're given the all clear. In terms of if any warning is given, oftentimes it's after the fact. So they have online warning systems that for many in the community are not easily accessible or even easily understood. When we're dealing with elderly populations, which we have many of in our communities along the Ship Channel, you know, getting on Twitter or getting on social media or going onto a very specific website to get that information can be very difficult. And unfortunately, local media outlets aren't going to cover, you know, a release unless you see a giant fireball in the sky or there's a giant explosion. So we have a huge population within Texas and in Houston that speak Spanish. Almost 30% of Texas households speak primarily Spanish. And what we see oftentimes during disaster or leaks or fires is that if an alert is given out, it's not given out in a means of communication that's easily or widely understood by the communities most impacted.
So there's no audible system like a horn that blasts, a signal that people would hear?
In the past, there used to be alert systems and horns in the community that would sound. And the Houston Ship Channel itself is over 52 miles. And so it is a patchwork of different communities and different counties as well. And so each one is slightly different, which also complicates getting alert out to communities. Because, for example, if a facility isn't in Harris County in Houston, but just next door in Pasadena, that's a different county. And their alert system is a completely different website. But they do have internal alarm systems at the facilities that can sound. But there's no guarantee that community that is right next to these facilities is able to hear those audible alarms. In the past, certain facilities used to have such systems. We have one facility not too far from our offices where we're speaking today that used to actually have an alarm system. But once it changed hands to a new corporate owner, they actually mothballed that alert system. So now there are no alarms.
Is there any state or federal government agency that's doing any kind of ongoing testing of the air, the water, you know, the soil for pollution?
There is a regulatory framework both at the federal, state, and county level for things like air monitoring. But what we're experiencing right now in the current landscape is regulatory backsliding. So in Houston, Harris County has a county air monitoring system that monitors air quality. At the state level, we have the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality that has their own TCEQ air monitoring network that is mandated by federal regulations such as the Clean Air Act. However, what we've seen oftentimes is even when there are exceedances of air emissions, for example, that are beyond federal regulations, outside of noting them, there isn't any kind of redress for those emissions. Sometimes a penalty is assessed against a company, but we haven't seen the kind of strong enforcement currently or even in the past that pushes these facilities to actually bring in these excess emissions, whether they're water discharges or emissions to air. So we do have regulatory frameworks that exist that are supposed to be monitoring these things. But unfortunately, what we've seen is even if we're getting data showing that more toxics than are permitted are being released, we're not seeing any kind of operationalization of bringing those emissions in and holding to account these corporations that are going past it.
You're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org. Again, you're listening to Mothering Earth Radio and this piece about the Houston Ship Channel and the effects of all of that on us, and especially the people living closest to the areas. We get back to that now.
And so you mentioned water discharges. So does this pollute your local water supply as well?
Petrochemical production is a water-intensive process. It requires water. Texas currently has been experiencing drought for several years, on and off different parts of the state. We're running out of potable water. We are now dealing with the expansion of desalination projects that are meant to take basically ocean water and try to make them potable, but not for use by humans and communities, but rather just for industry itself. And so not only are we dealing with chemical discharges into our water, but we're also dealing with the privatization of water for facilities.
Yvette, what evidence is there of health issues linked to the pollution from these plants?
Within 14 of the facilities along the Houston Ship Channel, there are 776 health impact points, ranging from cancer or elevated cancer levels in the community, developmental issues with small children who are growing into puberty, hematological issues. So think about blood diseases and how much oxygen blood can carry over into your lungs. Just having limited capacities for absorbing oxygen, it could be haptic issues. So issues with your liver, ocular, affecting your vision, renal and respiratory issues, neurological issues developing, and not only children in fetal development, but small children and even middle-aged, primarily healthy people who then experience memory loss, you know, that can then be attributed to aging diseases. We have body weight issues. So if you're thinking about what is a primary indicator for community health, the low birth weight in children is actually used by the federal government as an indicator for community health. And it's one that's affected through this kind of toxic exposure. Reproductive health. So in concern to communities' health and women's health, both women and men, and, you know, childbirthing people with sterility that's growing in the community, endocrine disruptors affecting hormones in our community members, where it also leads to sterility or different patterns of growth. Immunological issues. So your body isn't as strong to combat, let's say, the flu or other viruses, and instead of having a period of flu, you end up having a month worth of flu symptoms because your body can no longer handle it. Cardiovascular issues. We see a lot of folks within our communities having, you know, heart issues, strokes, even linkages to diabetes, which chemical exposure has been linked to diabetes. So the list goes on and on.
Companies responsible for these toxic emissions, which are happening regularly, are they doing anything about it?
At the end of the day, it comes down to profits over people's health. You think about oil, you think about gas, you think about fracking, you think about these massive energy companies making billions of dollars with little to no oversight, especially under the administration we're operating in. So when you have these two competing interests, profits in an oil state like Texas are going to speak much louder than the health of our communities. And unfortunately, that's the predicament we find ourselves in, is that as community advocates and community members, we're having to champion our own lives and fight for our own human rights for clean environment, the right to breathe clean air, water, and to live freely within our own communities.
Shiv, are these facilities expanding?
So new infrastructure is going in rapidly, and it's primarily fueled by plastics. So plastics are based on fossil fuels that are processed into petrochemicals that go to then create plastic precursors. And so what we have is a litany of new types of infrastructure that are co-located on existing facilities. So whether that's an ethane cracker, in which ethane is cracked, ethane is found in LNG, liquefied natural gas, frack gas, that then's cracked into ethylene, which is a necessary building block to make plastic products. We're also seeing expansion in the names of things like chemical recycling, which is essentially what the petrochemical industry says is a means to recycle plastic by burning it through pyrolysis back into its molecular building blocks to then create new products. But as we've seen, that technology is not actually able to do what industry claims. Less than 3% of that can actually be turned into usable product. And so we are seeing expansion, and unfortunately, we're seeing it be subsidized by our taxpayer dollars. And in terms of the petrochemical industry, over the past 5 years, we've seen along the Houston Ship Channel several of the facilities that are in our community add lines for polyethylene production or high-density ethylene production. And it's oftentimes being subsidized by county money or state money or, unfortunately, even federal dollars. And what it's really doing is metastasizing a problem. When you have the number of plants that we have, when they are so close to our communities, you start having to look at the cumulative impacts. It's not one facility that's putting out toxic air emissions or toxic discharges to water. It's 600, and it starts to stack on top of each other. And as these facilities expand, that then starts to expand and deepen the kind of risks and harms faced by our community.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan, here today with Yvette Arellano, founder and executive director, and Shiv Srivastava, policy director for Fenceline Watch.
You're listening to People of Earth here on KPFT 90.1 FM, kpft.org.
These companies say that they're bringing economic benefits to the community. Is that true?
This is the narrative that we often hear from the oil and gas petrochemical industry, that they are necessary economic drivers. But the vast majority of our communities, our port communities that are next to these facilities, are in the lower quartile of socioeconomic indicators. They're food deserts. They don't have access to healthcare. And a vast majority of the people that live near these facilities do not work in these facilities. In fact, the oil, gas, and petrochemical industry over the past several years has been moving to cut as many jobs as possible. And so what's occurring is that our communities along the port, along the Houston Ship Channel, are being asked to take on the environmental, the health, and the safety risks. And they're not experiencing any of the economic boom. And in fact, we're subsidizing nearly $1 billion worth of tax breaks for the petrochemical industry. We're giving subsidies, tax breaks to ExxonMobil. It's the seventh most profitable company in the world. They're receiving the largest subsidy of $200 million here in the state of Texas. So it's not only that our communities are not getting economic benefits from it. In fact, we are actually paying these facilities. We are paying the industry that is doing such harm to our community.
Yvette, are there any zoning laws?
A lot of people have that question because zoning is essential for safe communities and for the building of industrial zones, like the ones we're talking about. But in reality, zoning doesn't exist. And in fact, the city of Houston and cities like it are proud to say that there's a lack of zoning. And they use the guise of small business to kind of promote it, saying, well, you know, if you're trying to open up a family business, do you want us telling you where you can and can't put it, right? But we're not talking about family businesses. Like Shiv said, we're talking about multinational fossil fuel interests that are being sited next to schools and hospitals.
What strategies do companies use to override complaints from residents?
So let me quickly tell you about a community that's not terribly far from our offices where we're sitting today, known as Manchester. Here they have a playground, and right across the street is Valero. So the color of the playground is teal and yellow, and those are the colors of Valero. Those are the corporate colors of Valero. The park itself is a public-private partnership park. So the park actually dates back several decades. It's a very old park, but it is no longer run by the city. It's instead a joint partnership that includes several industry players, including Valero and Chevron and Exxon. the children go back to school every school year with branded backpacks of Valero and other industry players, because they give money for supplies and they provide backpacks. Houston's not just home to a giant petrochemical complex. We're also home to the world's largest medical center. And yet we don't see a lot of medical research coming out on the impacts of petrochemicals on human health here in Houston, because many of those hospitals and facilities have endowment by the oil and gas industry. And so what we see oftentimes is that oil, gas, and petrochemical interests have so ingratiated themselves in almost every facet of city and state, and unfortunately even national infrastructure, that it becomes very difficult to hold them to account. But what we see the reality of is that our taxpayer dollars are going to subsidize this industry, to prop it up, despite renewables and other new technologies that are much safer and more reliable, as we've seen during the many natural disasters Houston has had in the state of Texas. But we continue to use our taxpayer money to prop this up. And there's not enough discussion on the externalized costs. Children wouldn't have to go back to school with a bag that has an oil and gas logo on it if we weren't giving hundreds of millions of dollars away to a petrochemical company. We wouldn't have to rely on them providing school supplies or providing money for health screenings if we weren't externalizing the costs of the damage and the harms that they're doing to the community. So it's a rather toxic, and I use that intentionally, a rather toxic relationship that's occurred where the same players that are doing harm then step in as though they are providing a social service to undo the harms that they're causing. And we're actually footing the bill for it.
So what recourse do you and residents have?
For community members that are living along the fence line, your cell phone is such a powerful weapon. And like we see with the current ICE immigration raids, you know, simply documenting is its own powerful force, because then you're helping elevate and expose the reality of what's going on. And what's happened here is that, you know, people have assumed for years that third world countries in the global south are the only ones to shoulder toxic burdens, and they completely look away from what's going on in the Gulf Coast.
So that's all for People of Earth, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember, moving to Tuesdays at 7 p.m. Starting in, the following next week. And I'm Jacqueline Batiste signing out.
Standing all of 5 feet 2 inches high, Frankie Half Pint Jackson had a predictable nickname and a thoroughly unpredictable act. You're on the Sound Beat.
Don't need knocking on the blind. The baby, he's trucking up here to do the shucking. Don't need knocking on the blind.
Among the eclectic range of popular draws in vaudeville were female impersonators. Most of them fell into one of two camps: the coarser, more comedic performers, think Monty Python, and the true female mimics, performers like Julian Eltinge, whose elegant gowns would regularly draw female window shoppers. Frankie Jackson was more the latter, giving him a rather unique performing edge. He could sing songs written for both male and female singers, and would even perform duets all by his lonesome. Here he is with No Need Knockin' on the Blind, a Decca recording from 1937.
The baby, he's nursing, don't need to stop cursing. It ain't no need knocking on the blind. Oh, it's no need knocking on the blind.